fourth case this morning is Midland Coal against Director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs and Shores. Mr. Solomons.
Good morning. I'd like to take a moment at the beginning of my argument to talk about the change in the environment of this, the particular issues that are presented in this case that's occurred during the pendency of the appeal in this case to this court. Today, over 50%, these are Department of Labor statistics, of the claims that are pending before the agency are claims by people who I have sought to retry their cases two, three, four, and more times. To add to that, the claimants who are seeking modification of their claims two, three, four times, you have an astounding fact that in the population of claimants, 75% are not among the people that this program was originally intended to benefit. These are not working miners struck down. These are not survivors of miners who have been lost to their families during their working lifetimes. These are retirees who are attempting, under this regime, to redo and redo and redo. There is nothing.
Why aren't you describing a legislative problem? There's 20 CFR section 725.309D, which sets forth the conditions under which somebody who's had a previous claim for benefits denied can, after a period of a year has elapsed, refile a new claim. That's what the Department of Labor has said, and it's implementing the statute. Maybe it's foolish. You know, maybe it should tighten up. Maybe the Congress should amend the law. But right at the moment, if there's a right under the law, which there certainly is, if you look at our embanked decision in Peabody Coal against Spiess, to file a new claim, if you can show that you're entitled to benefits now without undermining the correctness of the earlier decision, and that's because of progressivity and other kinds of factors, you're entitled to do it. And your argument, which you know, certainly describes, you know, perhaps an administrative morass and so on. I'm just of the view that we may be the wrong people to be talking about it.
Well, let me say, first of all, this isn't a legislative problem. Legislation is what Congress does. There is nothing in this statute that permits this regime.
But you haven't challenged the legitimacy of 725.309.
No, but what we've done.
And it's a regulation. You think this court just gets to decide?
Well, that regulation is not, I don't know which one you're
there.
Reading. But it, I don't know whether it applies to this case because this case was filed before the Department of Labor revised its regulations. Under the old regulations, and in fact under the new regulations, what the Department of Labor intended was what is essentially an irrebuttable presumption that a miner who could come in and prove his claim now had proved that he had established a material change in conditions. What was required then, and what was required at the time this court decided Spiess and Sahara Coal, was that the miner establish a material change in conditions. The regime for doing that under those cases was that the miner was not permitted to re-adjudicate issues that had been previously adjudicated against him, re-litigate what had been decided before, unless it was something that was capable of change.
But look, the Department of Labor has a whole section in its brief about the degree to which subsequent claims can be filed or cannot be filed. And I take it you're just making a frontal attack on that whole section of its brief?
No. Your Honor, what we're arguing here, fundamentally in this case, is that this person falls within the category of people who cannot be awarded benefits under that regulation.
But your argument, as I understand it, is as a matter of fact, his type of so-called legal pneumoconiosis isn't the type you think that can be progressive. And the problem that you face is that you come down to a substantial evidence argument, because it was found, based on the testimony of Dr. Cohen and others, that his did progress.
Well, no, it wasn't found that his did progress. Dr. Cohen didn't say that his progressed. What Dr. Cohen said is that it was due to pneumoconiosis.
No, but Dr. Cohen also points out differences in blood readings, differences in, you know, there are physical things that changed from 1996 to the post-1998 period of time. No signs of it in 96, and the ALJ actually says that at one point in the opinion.
Well, Your Honor, that's factually incorrect. In 1981, when he first filed his claim, it was found that he had obstructive lung disease, which is precisely the same condition that Dr. Cohen found. It was found in 1981 by the Department of Labor that his obstructive lung disease did not arise out of coal mine employment. Now, it's not going to arise out of, and that issue, and this court's recent decision in Villain, which we cited as additional authority, that issue is not subject to re-adjudication.
Nobody
which issue particularly?
Well, it was already, it was determined that the disease he had of his lungs, his obstructive lung disease, was not caused by mining in any part. That was the decision in 81. It was also the decision in 94. He had it all the way through. The decision in 90... This
I understand is a substantial evidence argument based on our holding in Spies about the scope of preclusion. But that's why I'm puzzled, in part, as my colleague Judge Wood is, by why you seemingly want to challenge the correctness of Spies or complain about the regulations. I mean, it's fundamentally different to say there can never be any re-adjudication in black lung, which is one of the arguments in your brief, or that particular diseases can, as a matter of law, never be progressive, which you also say, and on the other hand, just to say there is a substantial evidence problem in this case.
Well, the problem in this case
is... not clear why you want to attack a unanimous en banc decision.
I'm not attacking
you. You aren't going anywhere.
I'm asking you to apply it. Let me read to you from the decision. It says, the key point is that the claimant cannot simply bring in new evidence that addresses his condition at the time of the earlier denial. He's bringing in new evidence to prove that a disease which was determined not to have been caused by his pneumoconia, not to have been caused by his coal dust exposure, all of a sudden, 16 years later, is caused by his coal dust exposure.
Well,
that is our principal argument here, and you go on in Spies and say his theory of recovery must be consistent with the assumption that the original denial was correct. The original denial found that the disease...
If the ALJ is entitled to credit Dr. Cohen, which the ALJ obviously did credit Cohen, does Dr. Cohen's testimony support your view that pneumoconiosis cannot arise for the first time after the end of coal dust exposure?
Well, the finding of the... Let me try to focus this a bit. Finding of the D.C. Circuit in NMA, which is where there was a rulemaking, and there was...
No, we know what the D.C. Circuit held. It would help me if you answered Judge Easterbrook's question.
It would help me
well.
If you answered Judge, my question.
Judge, too. Judge, I mean, the Dr. Cohen's testimony simply quibbles with the earlier determinations of the cause of the condition that's at issue here. That's all it does.
Now, the question I was asking is, if you look at the credited evidence in this case, does this record suggest that coal workers' pneumoconiosis, simple pneumoconiosis, is a disease that cannot first be manifested after the end of coal dust exposure?
That's not a relevant inquiry in this case. The disease in this case, this man didn't have simple pneumoconiosis. Nobody argues about that. The disease in this case was legal pneumoconiosis in the form of obstructive lung disease. That is the only disease that we're talking about here. And does the record in this case indicate that it can be of latent onset? No. Matter of fact, there is no...
Dr. Cohen said in his report that it could be. And he's a physician. I'm not a physician.
I beg to differ, Your Honor. He didn't say that it could be of latent onset. There's no medical literature in the rulemaking record or anywhere that I know of that establishes that obstructive lung disease as a result of mining can be latent in onset. And that's what Dr. Cohen's under, he never said it was, that is the theory of his testimony, is that it was latent in onset. That is a medical impossibility. That was proved in the rulemaking. There's nothing in the rulemaking to show that that's possible. And that's a different question than progressivity also. Latency and progressivity are separate issues. This case raises both of them depending upon the way you look at it and depending upon the alternative theories. Our initial theory, our principal theory in this case, is that the denial of this claim in 81 and the denial of the claim in 1986 established that this disease, his obstructive lung disease, which he had, did not arise in any part out of coal mine employment. Those decisions were as final as if they had been rendered by the Supreme Court. What happened in the 1999 fourth claim is they're relitigating it. That is almost inarguable. It doesn't matter what Dr. Cohen said. Dr. Cohen is disagreeing with the earlier determinations, and what Spies says is that you cannot do that. So does Sahara Cole. And the other side of that coin is if you say that the condition, that those determinations were wrong, that it wasn't out of it, then what you have is a situation that falls into, as a legal matter, this court's jurisprudence in the Vigna and Foster cases, which is that when the 1996 case was finally and completely denied, this man was 77 years old. He had had several heart attacks. He was nobody that age with heart attacks or without them is able to work in a coal mine.
Well, neither can dead people, and we have plenty of cases where it's the widow who's pursuing a claim. I'm not sure what to take from that. Yes, people get older as these cases
I don't
progress.
Know whether Judge Wood has examined the voter list in Chicago recently.
That's different from working in a coal mine.
Well, I think you can understand the problem that we're confronted with. These things get litigated over and over and over again, and nobody really pays any of the department has this passionate commitment to an orthodoxy which is just false about latency and progressivity. It's been proved. And we have what...
It would just make it just like every other governmental department. They've all got orthodoxies that are very hard to verify.
But these are proven to be false.
But if they've got a political constituency and it enacts and keeps in force a silly program, it's our job to carry it out.
Well, that wasn't what the take on this by the D.C. Circuit was, that they would have struck the rule down.
The D.C. Circuit said that the only thing that was important was that the department was entitled to say that progressivity is conceivable. It can happen. Maybe it happens in 1% of cases, maybe it happens in 5% of cases, but you cannot take a position as a matter of law that it never happens.
Well, Your Honor,
your problem is that that's the position
that
you want us to take.
That is not my position, and that was not our position in the D.C. Circuit. Our position
Well, I'm just saying the D.C. Circuit, to the extent relevant to this case, I think did not rule in your favor.
Well,
it said it could happen. Now let's look at the individual person. Let's look at the evidence.
What you have to look at is the individual. There's not just one kind of pneumoconiosis.
We
and
know
what,
that.
What the department tried to do is have a one-size-fits-all rule, which you cannot have under D.C. Circuit jurisprudence. You can't have it under the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's decision in Ragsdale was just like this.
Why is it one-size-fits-all rule if they just say it can happen, but let's see if
because
it did?
Because it can't happen in this case under these facts.
You never showed that, quote, this form
well,
of legal
question,
pneumoconiosis.
Well, the question, Delane says I don't have to.
I don't think so.
The Delane decision says that it's the claimant has this type of, if he thinks that this type of pneumoconiosis, I mean, we've shown there's no evidence anyplace, we've argued that all the way along, that this type of pneumoconiosis this obstructive lung disease could possibly
Dr.
be.
Dr. Cohen testifies to the contrary.
He
says on page appendix 11, while there are physicians, perhaps Selby is one, who believe that obstructive disease cannot be caused by coal dust exposure. There are numerous studies indicating that this belief is incorrect. It is clear that obstructive airways disease, bronchitis with or without significant obstruction, emphysema, result from coal mine dust.
That is not the issue
on
in this
and on.
Case.
It's
the
type
case,
of legal pneumoconiosis
we're not
that
arguing
we're talking
about. We never contested that. What we're arguing here is that it can't be latent. That's what we're arguing. We're not arguing whether it can be caused by. And so Dr. Cohn, there's nothing in Dr. Cohn's opinion to refute that. And as a matter of fact, there is stuff in Dr. Shelby's opinion that says this would be extraordinarily unlikely or something to that effect. But Dr. Cohn does not address that issue. So do we have to have the question here, I suppose, that I put to you is, we have the burden to put on a rulemaking record in every one of these cases, because we don't know which one of them goes to the courts of appeals. And I don't think that's a fair burden, especially when it has already been established in the D.C. Circuit that, number one, one size does not fit all, and it doesn't fit this case at all. And number two, we're talking about, and the Department of Labor is presuming something which is exceedingly rare and not at all true in this kind of situation.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the Court, Tom Johnson on behalf of George Shores, who's the coal miner here. I'm only taking 6 minutes, and let me be brief. I think the fundamental premise of the company's argument in this case is that legal pneumoconiosis, obstructive lung disease like Mr. Shores has, cannot progress. That is the premise of all of their arguments. It seems inappropriate for this Court to re-examine that question, because the Department of Labor spent 3 years hearing from the industry, hearing from all of the industry's experts, hearing from NIOSH, hearing from scientists and physicians who are interested in this progression and latency issue, and at the end of those 3 years came up with the rulemaking and 718-201, which is a provision that applies to this pending case. At the end of the rulemaking, they decided, yes, pneumoconiosis, simple pneumoconiosis, legal pneumoconiosis can be latent and can be progressive. They cited in the preamble, and we've given you the pages in our brief, to the epidemiological studies that establish that. So it seems, as I say, inappropriate for the company to ask this Court to re-examine that fundamental premise. True enough, we as the miner must prove that the progression happened in Mr. Shore's case. Doesn't happen in every case, and the department has been very upfront about that. Mr. Shores is the poster boy for the progression of obstructive lung disease. We have tried to point out in our briefs why that is true clinically, but we need go no further than the employer's own doctors. Dr. Selby is the one who, in his report, said that Mr. Shores, quote, clearly had progression of disease from near the end of his coal mine employment up to his 1999 evaluation. That is their doctor. So if this is a substantial evidence case, you hardly need to go beyond their own doctor. In addition, of course, all the X-ray evidence was negative for obstruction until 1999. The arterial blood gas testing was normal until 1999. The pulmonary function testing, which is in many ways the sort of hallmark of obstruction, dropped off the table in 1999. And, of course, this gentleman...
That's the one that went from something like 56 to 47 between...
Right, 73% is the ratio between his FEV1 and FEC. 73% at the time he left the mine, it's down to 47%. These are age-adjusted percentages, so he is dropping off the table. Remember, smoking, which is thrown up here by the company, this man quit smoking in 1971 and had a 15-pack year smoking history, which is almost inconsequential. So he is dropping rather dramatically, and of course, in the end, this man is walking around 80% of his day dragging an oxygen tank behind him.
Half a pack a day.
Half a pack a day for 30 years is a 15-pack year history, ending in 1971. Our doctors have said, Dr. Cohen, as you read his report, he's not denying that smoking may have some small component part of this, or account for some small component part of this man's condition. But his 26 and a half years of coal dust exposure obviously did too. In the end, we think this is a substantial evidence case, as I think Judge Wood has mentioned, and we think that as long as the ALJ here took a look at this clinical evidence and offered reasons, rational reasons, for opting for Dr. Cohen over Dr. Stillrid and Dr. Selby, that this Court should be satisfied with that result. So unless there's any questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Barber from the government.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Barber.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Barber. I represent the Director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs. Essentially, the coal company contends that the Department's regulatory definition of pneumoconiosis requires miners to present scientific evidence that they have the type of pneumoconiosis that is capable of arising and progressing after dust exposure ceases. The fact of the matter is the regulation was promulgated to make clear that the miner has no such burden. The regulation constitutes a finding of a legislative fact that chronic lung disease caused by coal mine employment is capable of arising and progressing after dust exposure ceases. And in fact, the D.C. Circuit, in affirming the validity of the rule, recognized that the rulemaking record supported that finding of legislative fact. It's true it doesn't happen in every case.
Could I ask you, Mr. Barber, suppose 2 years from now some huge scientific study is done yet again of coal miners, and it turns out that what was thought to be possible looks like scientifically it isn't possible. What's the route that the industry takes to make sure that this so-called finding of legislative fact is now corrected, if you will?
I think the first and probably the best route would be a petition for rulemaking. I mean, I think when an agency makes a finding of legislative fact, it's frequently resolving conflicting evidence. You know, it's not confined to making such a finding only when all the evidence supports it. I mean, there can be conflicting evidence, and there was a little bit of conflicting evidence here. And 2 years from now, if this new evidence comes up that demonstrates that perhaps the agency ought to take another look at this rule, a petition for rulemaking could be filed. And
okay. Let me ask you another question. It seemed to me in your brief you were rather strongly expressing the view that total disability was the factor that really did change from 1996 to the 1998 petition. Is that a correct interpretation?
I think that's true. That's based on our look at the entire record in this case. And it's, you know, Mr. Solomons has a point when he says that Mr. Shores has had some chronic lung disease since he retired from coal mining. I mean, there was a 1981 medical opinion that diagnosed chronic bronchitis, and in 1996 there's some diagnosis of chronic lung disease. And now, of course, it's more severe. He's got severe COPD. And now Dr. Cohen relates that to coal dust exposure. And the coal company's point is, well, if it's related to coal dust exposure now, how can you say it wasn't always related to coal dust exposure? And that was just a mistaken finding.
Right, yeah, why isn't that just now better evidence of the same thing, which is what we said you can't do in Peabody?
It may be. You can't do it to prove a change. You have to prove, and so that's why in this case we think the real change here is on the total disability element. Once he establishes a change on the total disability element, this court's opinion in Speezy allows him to relitigate the question of whether his chronic lung disease is caused by coal dust exposure. That's at page 1008 of Speezy, where there's a discussion of the frailty of alternative findings when an earlier claim is denied for one of several reasons, any one of which is sufficient to support the denial. The other alternative findings don't have preclusive effect in the future. And that's why he can relitigate the cause of his chronic lung disease. It's quite clear here that he's had progression to the point of total disability. Even Dr. Selby, the employer's expert, characterized, I believe he used the phrase considerable worsening, and he's had progression of his condition. There's no doubt that Mr. Shore's condition has progressed. And Dr. Cohen found that he was totally disabled. And quite frankly, although he didn't use the words, my guess is Dr. Selby thought the same thing. At least he characterized the disease as severe. And the ALJ compared that characterization with the exertional requirements of Mr. Shore's work and drew the inference that even the employer's doctor's opinion supported a finding of total disability. And that finding is independently sufficient to support the ALJ's conclusion that there's been a change in condition. And this court can affirm on that basis. It's true the ALJ hinged his change of condition finding on the element of pneumoconiosis, but the Benefits Review Board, in reviewing the ALJ's finding, recognized that there was also a change on total disability. The coal company would say that this court can't affirm the conclusion of a material change in conditions on a ground other than the ground cited by the ALJ, and it cites this court's Sahara Coal decision in support. But Sahara Coal is entirely distinguishable. In Sahara Coal, the ALJ made his finding of a change in condition based both on some old evidence and some new evidence, and that's improper. The finding of change has to be based solely on new evidence. The old evidence doesn't support a finding of change. And because no one, including this court, could tell how the ALJ would have ruled on the issue had he properly considered only the new evidence, his error was not harmless and the case had to be remanded. Here, on the other hand, the ALJ looked at the new evidence, the evidence of Mr. Shore's condition in 1999, and it established that he is now totally disabled. The ALJ didn't base his finding of total disability on any of the old evidence. In fact, he looked at Dr. Kim's report from 1996 and noted that that did not support a finding of total disability at that time because the impairment was only moderate. So unlike the Sahara Coal case, in which the court could not affirm the award of benefits on grounds that the ALJ didn't rely on, here I think it would be perfectly acceptable for the court to affirm the finding of material change on the total disability ground.
Mr. Barber, do you know what the amount of benefits that the petitioner was entitled to according to the ALJ's finding?
The onset date here, the commencement date of benefits, is November of 1998, which is the month in which he filed his claim. He will not get benefits for all these earlier periods when his earlier claims were denied. I think he has one dependent, his wife, so his benefits would be increased, monthly benefits would be increased for that. I'm thinking he would probably get about $700 or $800 a month starting November of 1998 until death, and benefits would cease upon his death. I think the only other point I just want to make for the record is that the court ought to reject Midland's res judicata argument. Every court that's considered the question, including this court, has held that res judicata doesn't bar a subsequent black lung benefits claim as long as the minor has proved a change in conditions. No court has required proof of additional coal dust exposure as a necessary element of a subsequent black lung benefits claim. The test is a change in condition, not subsequent coal dust exposure. So the legal res judicata argument ought to be rejected out of hand. So with that, we urge the court to affirm the finding of a material change in condition and reject the res judicata argument. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.